Hi everyone, welcome to A11 Crypto, and today I'm very glad to have Aya Kantarovich, who heads the institutional coverage from Falcom X, and we are going to talk about the evolution and landscape of trading. So I think this is a great time, especially given what's been happening in the traditional markets. So for people who may be new to this, Falcom X is an institutional-focused crypto trading platform with backing from AMX, XL Partners, Lightspeed. But I think the best person to introduce what Falcom X does and maybe her background is you, Aya. So I'll give the floor to you. Take it away.
Thank you. Thank you, Harvey. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more this morning. Elon Musk changed his Twitter bio to Bitcoin, so you really, in terms of timing, couldn't be more spot on today. So my name is Aya, as you mentioned, head of institutional coverage at Falcom X. As you described, we're an all-in-one solution for any institution trying to transact, trade, store, credit, clearing for cryptocurrency. And we're really trying to be that one-stop shop for institutions entering the space. And so we've scaled significantly, as you'd mentioned, recently raised from American Express. We now transact over $3 billion in trading volume a month. So really exciting growth for us at Falcom, and excited to continue expanding that growth, especially as, you know, the crypto markets heat up as we're seeing today. So thank you so much, Harvey, for having me. Excited to really dive into this topic today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's incredible, especially given your background. You were with, I think, Pantera in the earlier days, and then you transitioned to some more trading focus. So maybe just give us a bit more color on the learning curve you went through and what you discovered. And did you sort of like study out in crypto like to begin with, or how did that happen?
Yeah, great question. So no, I actually started out consulting. I definitely fell down the crypto rabbit hole. So started out as a banking and capital markets consultant in DC before joining my first startup, where I was the first hire of a buy side equity research startup in San Francisco. So scaled that company with a team in San Francisco and Chicago called Tegas, and had always had this itch to work in crypto. I had read the Bitcoin white paper, just absolutely fascinated by it. I used to have a mug at Tegas that the company gave me that every day's Bitmas for Bitcoin Christmas, and I was just absolutely hooked. And so when the opportunity arose at Pantera to join, I just couldn't let down the chance and worked very closely with Dan Moorhead, Paul Verratt-Attackett, Bill Healy, who was the president at the time, more on the venture side of the business. And as you mentioned, it was definitely a different time back then. This was coming off of the ICO boom. And so a lot of the companies that we were looking at were really, I would say, more M&A activity. So we were really focused at the time around centralized exchanges. So if we look back at where crypto was even like 3 years ago, it was actually really difficult to purchase Bitcoin. Whether you were retail, especially if you were an institution, you had these exchanges, but you had numerous exchanges. In the US today, when we think about exchanges, I think there's three or four. So you have the Coinbase, Kraken, Gemini. There used to be like 10 to 15. And so what happened is you saw acquisitions happen. You had Bitstamp in Europe acquiring all of the smaller European exchanges. Same thing happened both in Mexico with Bitso, in South America, in Asia. And so you were seeing a lot of that M&A activity, which was really interesting. On the back of that, to the ICO boom, you know, you had a lot of companies that were trying to raise a lot of capital without a product yet built. And so, you know, I think one learning for the industry is that's probably not the best way to fundraise and build rapport. And so, you know, that has changed significantly. But, you know, what's pretty cool to see today is that a lot of the companies that went through the ICO boom, for example, Polkadot, are now some of the DeFi blue chips that everyone speaks so highly of in terms of companies with just really large market caps and great product and marketplaces that people use today. So on the end of Pantera, we had actually invested in Tagomi, which was recently acquired by Coinbase. And so had an opportunity through doing due diligence to meet the Falcom X team, just fell in love with the team, the company, the culture, and had the chance to jump to Falcom X 2 years ago, really building and growing the institutional coverage team and where we are today. It's been exponential growth from day one.
I think we would love to hear how the industry changed, right? But maybe let's first set the stage. So I think most people probably do not know who are the players involved or parties involved in the life cycle of a trade. So maybe if you can shed some light into that. So who are the parties involved in executing a trade?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is kind of, you know, when you think about what's the mission of FalconX, it's to minimize all the different parties. But you hit the nail on the head. So the evolution of crypto started with you had your custodian, someone who would, whether it's through cold storage or hot storage, store your assets in a safe place. But before you could even custody your assets, you needed to purchase it. This was typically done on exchange. So you would either go to Coinbase, create an account, buy your crypto and hold it on exchange. Or if you were a larger institution, you would move it to a secure custody solution, which until recently was off of the exchange. Sometimes you would have a Ledger wallet, which was just that USB drive, or you would send it to a partner like, let's say, BitGo. So you had your trading entity, and then you had your custody entity. As these two started to grow, you started having multiple trading entities that specialized in different things. So this was primarily focused on, I would say, institutions. So let's say you're a large institution, you have $50 to $100 million in AUM, and so you're more price sensitive than the retail who's just going to buy on exchange with like a 2% fee. And so when you look at that, you start to really notice the different price differentiations across different exchanges. And it makes sense to have multiple accounts elsewhere. So let's say, for example, your BTC has a great price on an exchange, but let's say someone like an over-the-counter trading provider or a prop shop, because they're actively trading, is able to offer a really good price on Ethereum. And so you started having these market makers where, because they were trading on different exchanges, they were able to provide you prices that were really competitive because they were taking risk on their books. And so these are what we call the prop traders. And so suddenly, let's say you're the institution, you have your account on exchanges, you have your account with your prop shops and your OTC desk. Suddenly you go from like one screen to maybe like five or six screens, and you're trying to run all the different pricing during, you know, the volatility that you know of today in crypto, which is very high, can become a lot. In addition to that, you started seeing these clearing and settlement providers. So basically what happened, and still is a major pain point in crypto, is that moving money from partner to partner still takes a lot of time. And the reason for that is we're all based on the blockchain, the underlying blockchain technology. And so when when it's super busy, and let's say the Bitcoin blockchain is crowded, mm-hmm. There's going to be a delay between, you know, you confirming a trade on the blockchain and receiving the assets. And so you started having these middle clearing facilities. So for example, Fireblocks, where, and the Silvergate SEN network, where because they knew exactly how much assets sit within these different custody wallets, because they had access to these custody wallets, they could take on a little bit of risk and transfer the assets quickly within their own network, and then confirm it on the blockchain. And so again, all of this is like the maturation of speed in this early nascent environment. So I think we talked about custody, clearing, the exchanges, you had your OTC desks, the market makers, the prop shops. What else am I missing?
No, I think you covered a lot. Yes, I think, yeah, maybe lending a bit more. So I think it's great that you paint this picture of how things evolved. And I think part of the reason for that evolution is that in traditional finance, when you execute a trade, right? You may be trading on margin, right? So maybe mm-hmm. let's go into lending. Where does lending come in?
Yeah, spot on. You're spot on. It's actually one of the really great things about crypto to see in the evolution of crypto is is the maturation of derivatives. And you'll see that in just the volumes that are traded. It starts with futures, and then you'll see it eventually with options. And what that means is also that the people, the traders that are coming into the space are more experienced, in order to facilitate these more difficult financial instruments, such as an options trade across different platforms. So exactly to your point, most traditional finance folks trade on leverage and use some level of margin. What's been great initially, the crypto industry just started with spot. And so you had to pre-fund an account, there was very little risk, and you were buying basically what you had in your account. We then expanded to something that's called T+1 24-hour settlement cycles. So this is what FalconX uses, only for institutions, where we do like a risk review on your balance sheet, and we're comfortable with you settling within 24 hours. So there you suddenly have like a 24-hour margin. And so it's this like T+1 kind of industry settlement standard. In traditional finance, you typically have T+2. And so on top of just time of executing the trade, you have 2 days to settle. And so now suddenly people are giving you margin for those 2 days. And all of this becomes calculating risk, which is the hardest thing to do, but also the most important thing to do in crypto when volatility moves so much. And so suddenly you are seeing that, these, whether it was exchanges, whether it was these OTC desks, whether it was even like FalconX, a digital asset trading platform, sometimes we needed this repo market. We needed short-term loans to borrow in order to facilitate T+1 for our clients beyond, our balance sheet. And so you had these really large lenders take advantage of that position. BlockFi, notably, you had Genesis, Matrixport, blockchain.com. And so they were really able to facilitate the growth of crypto through the ability to, again, it's always how many times can you flip your book? How many times can you provide, T+1 margin in a very safe way within your credit risk standards? And so I think the introduction of leverage and margin, both for trade execution platforms and for traders who are now able to trade safely, even just like 2 to 5x, really, really grew the industry, again, just specifically kind of crypto native to start.
That's fantastic. People, I think BlockFi as a name and brand name in crypto, people mostly, if you're not on the institutional side, you just think of it's a place where you put your money in, you lend to them, you get a percentage return. And maybe people didn't know realize how they generate their own return, right? So when they have all these assets on their balance sheet, I guess they can lend it out. And maybe the next thing we can dive into is that it seems that these players have specific roles, but they don't just play one role, right? They are expanding across certain verticals and doing a bunch of different things. So maybe let's talk about the expansion of these players and how what sort of business verticals can they expand into. So for example, I believe FalconX was focusing on execution, but now if I check my website correctly, I think FalconX is also offering prime brokerage. So maybe let's talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one thing to define is what does a brokerage mean? We kind of see ourselves more as just like an all-in-one platform. And I think if you compare yourself to like in traditional finance, Fidelity is your brokerage. And what that means is they're trading and their custody and their settlement, and that's it. When you think about your investment bank, or sometimes, outside of just the brokerage definition, like the Goldman Sachs does things that are completely different than what the Fidelity does. And so I think, I always say this, but in crypto, we love labeling things from marketing perspective. Everything's crypto and everything's blockchain and everything's brokerage. But when you double click on that, what does that actually mean? And for us, I think you bring up a really good point. What was interesting is that everyone wanted to expand into additional verticals and really just make the life cycle of a trade easier for the end user. And so You know, some, let's say, like on the BitGo side, they started out with custody and then they moved into lending and now they're moving into trading and settlement. For us, we started off with trading. We moved into margin and lending, and then we're moving into clearing as well as partnering with custodians to offer that kind of all-in-one solution. Same thing with some of these other networks where perhaps they're starting off from, let's say, BlockFi. They started off with lending, they're moving into trading, and then they'll move into potentially custody. You know, one thing that I think it's really interesting, even Coinbase, for example, I think Coinbase is a great example of that. So they started off with trading, now they have custody, and now they have this agency with the acquisition of Tagomi, this agency broker where they're aggregating pricing. So with each one, I think it depends on the persona, and I don't think there's going to be one winner takes all. I think what's important to realize is who's the end user. Is the end user retail? In which case, you know, like it's really nice to have that all-in-one solution and you're not price sensitive. So you're okay with the Coinbase model. Or is the end user going to be a high frequency trading firm where price is super, super important? And maybe they don't feel comfortable with, let's say, like a lender both custodying their assets, storing their assets, right, settling with all the counterparties and knowing exactly who they trade with. So there's that level of privacy. And so what we've seen work really well for us is because we're partnering with custodians, we don't see the assets and we're not necessarily the settlement layer either. We're making sure that that privacy is kept. And we're just focusing on, you know, how do we get the best price and execution and customer experience for our, you know, end user, which right now is this like white glove, you know, institutional investor. And so I think as the space continues to grow, the pie is also getting bigger. And all of these personas want different things. Like a retail, you know, Robinhood trader wants something very different on their phone than, let's say, you know, a $500 million asset manager. And, you know, for example, an endowment, which is a completely different user. In comparison. And so I think what'll be interesting is, you know, who combines that all-in-one solution and where do we need almost like a third-party clearance or a third-party custodian to maintain that level of privacy and security?
It seems to me that in the traditional financial world, there is this neat separation between different roles, and that gives people the comfort. And if the traditional guys were to come into crypto, they may not be familiar with the current setup, and therefore that might be a barrier for them to enter into the market. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I completely agree. So I think there are a lot of projects that are working on this right now and making a lot of improvements to the space of clearing. So I think clearing is you know, traditional finance is very used to clearing and having this FDIC insured, you know, third party check on all transactions that are happening. In crypto, you know, if you send it to the wrong address, we can't return it. If, you know, you happen to send the wrong amount, there isn't that level of insurance that I think some of these large institutions are looking for. So I definitely think that that's a barrier of entry. And that's why these institutions are more likely to go to something that's fully vertically integrated, so they don't have to send their money around to multiple places, and they have, let's say, a designated representative who's doing it on their behalf. For, I would say, this like middle tier that's more exploratory and is looking to trade, let's say, on a derivative exchange on one side and a spot exchange on the other, I think companies like Fireblocks and Xmargin, where they're looking to use technology to just see what's in every account to help with cross margin across different platforms, that becomes really interesting. And there's a lot of technology where if you look at, like, you know, privacy, where like the only person that has access to the account is just this basically calculator, settlements calculator, that will just calculate how much is in each account and then will give the final amount to the end user, or let's say the end trading platform. And I think that once we grow that, will really help the obstacle you mentioned.
Oh, yeah. And maybe I'm going to ask a question for those of us who may be less familiar with the traditional finance. And that is, what is the difference between a trading venue and the people who are actually taking your bid or ask? Because the people who are taking your bid or ask may be a market maker, whereas a trading venue is just a technology company. What's the difference there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So one of the things, I have a whole list that I kind of walk through when when I think about, you know, how do you define a liquidity provider, which is really what I consider just like the bare bones of what each of us are. And so the first question I ask is this a riskless principal or is this an agency dealer? And the difference there is, for example, FalconX, we're riskless. So we are the only person that you're ever going to interact with on a trade. So let's say, Harvey, you come to me and you're like, hey, I want to buy 10 BTC. I execute the 10 BTC with you. And because I'm a riskless principal, I'm not taking that onto my book. I hedge it off immediately. And so I don't have a position and I'm not axed on one side or another side. There is no incentive for me not to show you the prices that I receive. So that's one. The agency dealer is a different model where you come with 10 BTC and the agency shows you all of the different venues that they could split your assets to. Now, the difference between the two is we at FalconX have seen that we are able to tap into really unique liquidity because we're not disclosing who that liquidity provider is. So let's say there's a mining farm or a venture capital firm, and they pass KYC AML and we're using them because they have a bunch of liquidity for a certain token. They don't want to disclose that publicly, and therefore we're able to tap into it. When you are able to publicly disclose, typically what you'll see is it'll go to exchanges. A lot of these prop shops and OTC dealers do not want to publicly disclose their pricing because it also means that, you know, other people can now become more competitive in terms of how they're pricing once it's all publicly available. So those are the two, I would say, on the broker side. Then, as you mentioned, there's the prop shops and the OTC desks. And so I think what's interesting there is one of the things you have to think about is, are they operating based on positions on their book? So therefore, are they incentivized to show one price versus another price? And sometimes that could be good because it means they're axed. What we say, they have, let's say, a super long position, and so they'll show you a great price on that asset because they have that position. Sometimes it means that they'll go really wide because, you know, they're axed against that position and therefore not going to show you the best price. So I always look at that as you know, these are definitely sometimes the people where there is also a slight risk of front running because there's always the incentive that they're trading on behalf of their book and something to keep in mind. And then another thing too that's really important is to that point is last look. And so last look means that the whether it's the market maker, the prop shop, the OTC desk, that they are again trading on behalf of their positions on their book. And if they you know, are showing you a price and then the market moves and it's against their favor and they say off on this price, it means they had the last look and they didn't perhaps honor that price. And so these are all things, again, it kind of gets down to the nitty gritty of you know, I would say really just where can you get the best price and what relationships do you want to build? And, you know, I think at least for FalconX, our ability to aggregate all of that means at the end of the day, we have to deal with the different types of liquidity providers. But, you know, it depends on their persona. I would say most will go to an exchange where it's just an order book. They're matching the buys and the sells of different market makers trading on both sides. And then you're open to slippage, you're open to trading fees. But, you know, the access might be a little easier if you're a retail investor.
Right. And one of the things that fascinated me was that, you know, if you go to CoinGecko or CoinMarketCap and you look at the price, right, it shows you one price for BTC. Now you click into that, then you have, I don't know, 100 prices for BTC. And if you're not institutional, actually, even if you are institutional, okay, but how do you make sure you're getting the best price, right? As a retail guy, you probably don't care that much because you're not trading on volume. But as an institutional guy, like, how do you make sure of that?
Yeah, I'm so happy you brought this up. I was recently talking to someone in Switzerland who brought this up as well, and he was like, I just am looking at these different data providers and the price of Bitcoin is different on all of them, and I'm just trying to figure out where can I find the price of Bitcoin. And my response to that is it's just not a mature market yet, and that's why there's arbitrage opportunities. And that's why a lot of traditional finance folks are coming into this space, because an exchange in Korea is gonna might have a different price to Bitcoin based on an exchange in the US. And it's all because of just supply and demand. And so this is, again, to your earlier point, why you'll have folks with like six, seven different windows up, because they're just trying to find where the best price is of Bitcoin at that time. And it's actually a lot of the work that we do on the back end. It's that unsexy part, which is really just cleaning data. It's cleaning timestamps. It's making sure that the data from all these different exchanges, OTC, prop shops all match. And making sure that the data isn't stale. That's actually super, super important, making sure you're taking out wash trading, making sure that these prices actually exist and there's liquidity behind those prices. It's not perfect. And I think it really just depends on the person. If you are an institutional trader, you'll have probably APIs connected to multiple different price feeds, or you'll just try to find an aggregator that can do that for you. If you're a retail investor, at that point, you're just going to take, the price on Coinbase and execute.
And that this sort of leads me into my next question, which is that a lot of the DeFi projects, right, they all need a price feed. And most of the price feed they get from Chainlink. Now, Chainlink is a price aggregator, I suppose, and they pull price from different bunch of sources. Nobody knows who they are. I don't think they are disclosed. But wouldn't it be better? I don't know if there is a regulatory hurdle there, but like for projects just to pull prices from you guys instead. Do you think that, I guess, if we go back one level up from this question, specific question is that how do you see traditional finance, the way people do that, and the DeFi sort of being able to bridge together, and how would they interact and meld into each other?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So right now, to date, it's actually vice versa. So with the movement from centralized liquidity providers to decentralized liquidity providers, what ended up happening is the centralized liquidity providers, like we have price feeds that come from Uniswap, just so we know where the market is and we make sure that we have that data. I don't think, to your point, it's going vice versa. And there's definitely a risk with, having one data provider monopolize, for example, all of the data feeds. And I think a lot of these projects, to the point on Uniswap, they are aggregating multiple price feeds from multiple different locations. But if you're a smaller decentralized app, to your point, sometimes they'll just use Chainlink. There are other data, really great data providers like the Graph, and they'll use them to aggregate their data. There's always a risk that, for example, the data, if let's say you have an options contract, I always use this example. You have an options contract for, let's say, tomorrow, that, if the sky is blue, I'll give you $10. But what if tomorrow, Chainlink accidentally glitches and tells me that the sky is purple and suddenly you pay me $10? There's a risk that that definitely happens in DeFi. I think, as these projects get larger, they do start to aggregate from different liquidity providers, but we haven't reached that point where DeFi is aggregating from traditional. It's definitely the other way around, where the gateway to DeFi for some of these larger institutions tend to come from centralized liquidity providers. And then there's still a bit of a roadblock for ease of entry into some of these more decentralized platform. And to your point, fear just around the fact that this could be manipulated.
Sure. And I guess, one thing that I'm always curious about is that you mentioned Uniswap. I think a lot of people use Uniswap at their price reference point, but Uniswap has a very dumb pricing algorithm, right? And I do believe that centralized financing, like again, maybe I'm wrong, but I do believe like you guys trade, I don't know, I think I don't 30 billion in one quarter, but that sort of volume should be I don't know. Is that more or less than DeFi, or because I imagine the more volume, or I guess the more real volume there is, the better the reference price is.
Yeah, good question. So to date, I think month over month, Uniswap, and it depends on how DeFi is doing, will be right aligned with Uniswap month over month. And a lot of that, when you look at just the breakdown of the volumes on Uniswap, it's primarily what's really interesting. It'll primarily be wrapped ETH and Ethereum, and some of these stable coins into different altcoin pairs. And so I think Uniswap definitely, from a go-to-market perspective, has really positioned themselves as an entry point for folks to, you know, change. Let's say they come to these exchanges, because there is no fiat off and on ramp mm-hmm. on DEXs. And so you still need that centralized fiat KYC'd on and off ramp before you can then take it to, let's say, Uniswap and convert it into a token where, let's say, you can yield farm it, for example, another DeFi term. But yeah, I think to date, it just really depends. One thing that I will say exchanges have done a really good job of is making sure that exchange listings for some of these top coins are brought onto exchanges very quickly. I think last night, you know, Binance already launched Dogecoin in multiple different currencies, like Euro, and just given, you know, the Elon Musk rally. And so, you know, exchanges are definitely keeping up. But to your point, one thing I think, even taking a step back, that's really important about Uniswap is the ultimate purpose of the position from the project. So we work with a lot of projects where we advise them on listing as well as market making for them. And what we've seen in that is what you see also in traditional finance. It's very expensive to partner with, let's say, Goldman Sachs or your investment bank or your exchange to list. And in crypto, that can be anywhere between 200K to 300K. If this is a project that just launched, they may not have that, you know, much money on their balance sheet to spend just on listing. And it puts a lot of pressure for them for that to be their only go-to-market strategy. And while I think these exchanges do a great job of taking these projects to market, a lot of it is also timing. And so you could get really unlucky and just burn through 300K. And so Uniswap provided an ability for these projects not to pay anything, just provide, you know, that liquidity on the DEX, but not pay a listing fee in order to take their product to market. And I think that's really, really important, because it means that exchanges, in the same way that Goldman Sachs, isn't the gateway for what can and can't list to, you know, anyone in the ecosystem. It means that, you know, the power of, you know, whether or not to invest is now in the hands of you or I, as opposed to, let's say, Binance listing, you know, team or the Coinbase listing team or Kraken. So I think that democratization of project listing is really a huge benefit. And to your point, comes at the cost of sometimes inaccurate data feeds and perhaps not the best experience, but also the ability to get in really early at a project that you know, truly believe in and allow them to use that as a fundraising mechanism early.
Okay. I think you answered that brilliantly. And I think what I got out from there is that I think Uniswap has its own particular market positioning, its own utility.
Mm-hmm.
And that is allowing projects to launch easily, quickly, cheaply, much more so than if you were having to go to Binance and, you know, mm-hmm. go through their stages, right? And once the project becomes mature, then maybe it may make sense for just because of market demand for you guys to come in, for bigger players to come in and make much tighter spread.
Exactly. You're okay. Spot on.
Okay, brilliant. And I guess, you know, one of the sort of things that personal curiosity, right? How do people execute trades, right? On, let's say, a platform like FalconX. Do people still message each other? to execute the trade?
Yes, they do. So, we're definitely moved away from phone calls. So it's not like, Wall Street movies, where people are calling on the phone saying, okay, I want to execute so and so of this token. Can you do that for me now? And then you give the price over the phone, but it's all moved into Telegram. And I really do think that Telegram solely facilitates at least the initial waves of this industry. So now you have Telegram, you have Signal, and you have Skype, and these are primarily the major messaging apps for us to interact with our clients on an encrypted basis. And so the life cycle of a trade happens, at least at FalconX, an institution will go through KYC AML, they'll go through a risk committee review, and then once we launch them and everything is cleared, let's say someone comes with a list of tokens. We have three different ways that clients interact with us today. It's either through chat. So let's say they want a white glove experience, the trade is over 10 to 15K, or they're trading a very illiquid asset that, based on their jurisdiction, we can facilitate for them. Then they would come to chat. And so our traders would facilitate that. We've seen a massive increase of that over the last 5 months. The persona of clients that want a white glove handheld experience has definitely increased, and especially in a market that's this volatile, a lot of people just don't want to watch the market as closely. And so one of my favorite personas that recently traded with us this way was actually a senior care home who came to us and said, hey, we are hoping to diversify our balance sheet and would like to trade a lot of these tokens. Can you please help us facilitate that? And even a few days ago came back and said, this initial purchase was great. Can you help us dollar cost average? Can you just set up a TWAP for us and facilitate? Like, I don't want to look at it at all. I'm happy to pre-fund my account and just you facilitate the rest of the trade. And so that's on the white glove, I would say trade execution via Telegram. You're pinging real humans. If an issue comes up, you can call us. That's more the traditional side. Then you have a GUI. And so this is very similar to like Robinhood. You go in, you log in, you see the prices of the different assets, and you can buy or sell. You'll see your wallet description of your positions, and then you can settle in and out. And so this is, much more independent. You don't have to interact with us unless it's, let's say you have questions around settlement. And so it's much easier facilitation for some of these top like 10 to 15 tokens. And as you mentioned, finally, the last one is for our systematic traders. So anyone who wants APIs can plug into our API documentation, pull pricing feeds either through fixed or through streaming in engagements and trade on those different markets through the APIs and settle that way. So I would say those are three. You'll see those across typically all different platforms, but three of the major ones.
And so I think that the trading interface has been sort of worked out, right? But in terms of like what needs to happen, what are the three top things that need to happen in order for the crypto trading market to be bigger, more liquid, deeper, more transparency, right? Ease of use to get more traditional finance guys coming. What are the three things that need to happen in your view?
That's a great question. So I feel like I harp on this almost daily, but it's always the unsexy problems that are the major pain points for everyone. Even in traditional finance, probably the one thing that you spend the most amount of money on is trade reconciliation and back office trade operations. And so settlement is a pain point across the board. And the reason is because, as you mentioned even earlier, is that sometimes, someone executes at this time, and so they're doing a trade reconciliation at this point in time and this price, whereas we're doing it at a different price and a different point in time. That creates a lot of friction. The other two is just the ability to facilitate settlements quickly. And so, it all becomes a question of risk and balance sheet, and cost of capital, which is actually really expensive in crypto, because surprisingly, traditional banks want to lend out to crypto banks. And so the cost of the US dollar has a pretty high interest. And so I think if, as an industry, we're able to solve trade reconciliation and trade operations in a very smooth way, That'll be huge. I mean, people try to outsource this constantly, and it's a very expensive problem. But it's not a problem that technology can't fix. And a lot of projects are working on it today. So I would say trade operations is probably the biggest one, just settlement. The next is, as you mentioned, if we go into outside of these more traditional players and we look at DeFi, a lot of this is pertaining to just education, in my opinion. And so, like, even before we started the call, you're telling me about your colleague who didn't know what Uniswap was and thought a DEX was Coinbase. And so that's, at the fault of the industry, perhaps for not talking about this, in a louder voice and in a clearer fashion, and really explaining the value propositions of each of these different platforms and the differences between each of them and the risks associated with it. I think the most important thing is just to make sure that, before anyone trades on any platform, you know the risks well. And that leads me to the last point. It's really just security. I think everyone is very concerned around, if someone mentions that one article where the guy forgot his password to his Ledger wallet and he had two more tries, I'm just like banging my head against the wall. But, there are different ways to secure passwords in a fashion that's safe. You can write it on a piece of paper, you can store that piece of paper in a safe in a bank. People have figured this out before. And so I think, just being really smart about how you're storing your cryptocurrency, how you're trading, where you're leaving it, and the counterparty risks associated with all of these. Again, it leads me back to education, but I also think that's really important. So those are the three for you.
I think that's brilliant, right? So basically, I think if we are able to be able to settle trades more quickly, if that people believe their assets are secure, I think especially with traditional players, they are used to their way of doing things. No reason they should change. So you build a system where I can feel comfortable when I come in. I think that's the way it has to be. And then a lot. I think lastly, you mentioned is just that. What was the last thing you mentioned? Was the third thing? Security.
Education.
Oh yes. Okay. Speaking of education, let's do this, right? I so I think people who are listening to our talk would have known that the whole drama with Wall Street bets, right? And the whole drama with Robinhood shutting people down. Now, what are they? I think this will highlight the censorship resistance nature of decentralized systems such as Ethereum, BTC, so on and so forth. Do you think that are there ways that from where you're sitting, you're as an industry player, you could I don't know, help people being able to do what they supposed allowed to do all the time without suddenly changing the rules of game?
Yeah, great question. So, one thing I want to highlight is FalconX has stayed up. Our uptime is 99.999%. But if you would compare that to Coinbase, and I have the utmost respect for them, but when volatility spikes, Coinbase goes down. And so inherently, what I see that as is the inability to remain up is also not providing full financial opportunities for the people trying to get in and out of positions. And so what we need is something that's decentralized. And I do think that there is an ability to regulate DeFi in a way that benefits all the players. I think the major concern for the US is just the money laundering and the non-engagement of terrorist and blacklisted wallets, which, definitely, again, this space has some of the most brilliant minds, is something that we can figure out a way to do without, disclosing everyone's data or provide, not allowing everyone to have some level of privacy. So to the point on DeFi, yes, I think it is pretty wild to me that a US regulator would, come in and tell a platform you're only allowed to, we're asking you to shut down one side of trading, as opposed to what we've seen in the past with some of these private platforms such as the S&P, NASDAQ, which, because they're private companies, are allowed to do whatever they want. shut down trading across the board for all users for all sides. What we saw here felt like it was much more targeted. And what's concerning is, again, who had that information prior to close? So were people front running? And if people were front running, one of the biggest things, and I think the more power to the US, is the emphasis on protecting retail users. And so if this inherently hurt retail users, which I do believe it did, that's really bad. It sets a bad precedent for both, you know, can we trust our regulators to protect retail? And then, you know, who are they really serving? Is it Citadel or is it mom and pop that wanted to buy some AMC because it went up, you know, 300%? So I think to your point, it definitely created much more excitement for censorship-less, censorship-resistant platforms like blockchain. I think, you know, the questions around is blockchain there for mass adoption still exist, where, you know, we still can't process as many transactions as Robinhood can for AMC without, you know, it was incredibly slow response times and just fees going out the wazoo. But I completely agree. I think the value proposition is there. And what we were seeing at Falcon X was, you know, the price of Uniswap started increasing, the price of 1inch and some of these decentralized exchanges started increasing. People were buying a lot of these different blockchain networks like Polkadot. Near just raised an additional round, and the price of Ethereum increased. And then you were seeing, you know, Elon Musk and Initialized Capital start to put Bitcoin into their Twitter header. And I think it's gaining momentum, and that's really great to see, because this is the value add that we've been pitching for a while. And so this gave us the opportunity to say, well, you know, we're here. So you just let us know when you want to use us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When I heard the news, I thought this was outrageous. Like, even legally, you know, people had to sign the user agreement where they consent to you changing the rule of the game, to see it happening in real life was a different thing. I mean, for the people who are on the wrong side of these, actions, I think retail guys, I think, retail guys should always understand the risk they're taking. But the whole landscape, the risk calculation would totally change had they known that, hey, you're going to get shut out, that you cannot, you know, exit your position. So, yeah. And another thing that I feel really interesting is that, I know that Falcon is focused on institutional players, right? And you mentioned 50 to 100 million, I guess, balance sheet, right? But I think for anybody who's involved in crypto, everybody would like to have a better execution, better pricing, better performance. At first, when I first sort of realized, I think I was doing an episode with people who are running a DEX project. At that time, and maybe to a certain extent right now, I understand that, you know, people like, you know, me or others who exiting trade may not be price sensitive, but if I can get a better price, I would like a better price. Why wouldn't I, right? I don't know what is a barrier for maybe people like me to getting onto, you know, Falcon X. Like is there like a way of doing this, or you know, just simply because the cost for you guys to provide that service is just so much, it makes no sense for you to, you know, do the 10K, 20K, 30K sort of like trades?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, one thing I want to talk about is kind of the evolution of our client personas. So we used to be super crypto native, I would say like a year ago, and crypto native funds, hedge funds, venture funds, systematic funds. And then we started moving into Q3, Q4 of last year, where we started seeing, as I mentioned, senior care homes, more institutional players, what I would call these like SMBs that wanted to allocate into the space, and primarily one of our largest personas right now is retail aggregators. So these include, the PayPals of the world, SoFi's, the Revolut's, Cash App's. And so when you think about where do these people get their pricing, they're definitely not prop trading. And so, they're sourcing that liquidity from folks like FalconX, where, you know, we're acting as the wholesaler in that agreement to provide, you know, that almost 100% uptime, which is super, super, super important, and constant execution guarantees. As a retail, I think most people don't realize this, but when you go to execute, you always expect, you know, that it'll go in, buy, and execute. But actually on the back end, a lot of the times the price is moving significantly. And so there's a lot of work that needs to go on the tech side to guarantee that you always get filled on a price. And so I think to that point, you know, we I think FalconX might be behind a lot of the platforms that retail folks are using today. And, you know, that allows us to really focus on the underlying technology that just has a long way to go to provide the prices that you get. In terms of retail today, the cost is definitely high, as you mentioned. And I think for us, it's really exciting to focus on what does that all-in-one vertical look like, both, you know, in the US, in Asia, and then, you know, around the globe, and continue to be that wholesaler.
Right. I think one last thing we should touch up on is what geography do you cover?
Yeah, good question. So we cover all institutions, ECBs, as long as they're in an institution. Our largest markets to date are US and Asia. We have markets in South America, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, Southeast Asia, Australia. So we kind of cover the globe. We don't have the poles, the North and South Pole yet, but we'll work on it. As long as we have a pretty stringent KYC AML process, so as long as everything passes through our compliance process and you're an institution, we're more than happy to service those folks.
Right. Fantastic. Fantastic. If people want to learn more about how to onboard onto FalconX, where should they go? What's a touch point there for them?
Yeah, good question. So, can either reach out to www.falconx.io. You can also reach out to clients@falconx.io or onboarding@falconx.io. So we'll catch all of it.
Brilliant, brilliant. So for those of you who are lucky enough to enjoy the benefits of institutional trading, go for it. So guys, thank you so much for tuning in, and I'll see you next time.